And welcome to We Are History, and it's a painful one today, not just because John's going to be leading on it.
Thank you for your support as ever, Angela.
No, I'm really nervous about this one, John, because this is playing into a real phobia of mine, but I'm going to be a brave girl. I hope I get a brave girl sticker at the end of it. Lollipop, sugar-free. Because we're not talking battles or treaties today. It's not kings and queens or politicians and statesmen. Although nobody was exempt from one of the greatest scourges of mankind down the centuries. We are talking about teeth.
Yes.
Bad teeth, rotten teeth, how people dealt with them.
Ugh. We are doing a history of dentistry. And I like those episodes when we do how the ordinary people lived in the olden days, what they did with their sewage or what they did for contraception.
Yeah, you just like poo and sex jokes.
Exactly.
That's what you like.
Yes, it's probably that.
Yeah.
My source for this episode was An Excruciating History of Dentistry by James Windbrandt.
Can I just say, I think you're terribly brave reading that book, because I would have seen the title of that book and gone, absolutely no way, thank you very much. And I'm not squeamish when it comes to, you know, I used to be a nurse, blood and guts I can deal with, but there's something about dentists.
You hate it, yeah. Laurence Olivier in Marathon Man, that does it for you, with a drill and a strapped to the chair.
I'm going to take my earphones off while you say that.
Well, what I'd say about this subject is that an issue that really affected everybody for thousands of years. And yet you hardly ever see it in period dramas or read about it in the history books. How many days must have been ruined down the centuries by toothache with no cure? How many days?
12?
12 days, yes, Angela. No, it's definitely more than that. Anyway, it was a rhetorical question.
27 days.
I'm just going to ignore you, Angela.
Okay, fine.
When that First World War film was recolored by Peter Jackson, what was that called?
They Shall Not Grow Old.
Yes, that's it. The thing you immediately noticed was how terrible everyone's teeth were. So we're used to period costume dramas with healthy American actors with impeccable, even white teeth. So we forget that everyone's teeth were brown and wonky and all falling out.
So I'm going to ask the question I love to ask, John. How far back are we going?
You'll be pleased about this, Angela. I'm going back 250 million years.
Yes, get in.
A fossil from a Devonian dinosaur that was submerged under the sea in present-day Ohio records the oldest traumatic dental injury yet identified. What about that?
Wow.
The petrified remains of a fish-like creature, 20 foot long, bears the scars of an abrasion caused by its cuspid-like dental organs. So who knows what happened to that poor creature's teeth, but of course it couldn't go to the dentist.
Oh, really? Dinosaurs didn't have dentists? I've learned so much doing this podcast with you, John.
Stick around. This is historical gold dust, this is. Periodontitis, that is the bacterial destruction of the periodontal tissue, was rampant on land by the Miocene epoch of the Cenozoic era.
Well, that's what I always say.
Yes, I've heard you. That was in your wedding speech, wasn't it, Angela? The mandible of the three-toed horse of the period shows clear signs of destructive decay. Mastodons also had dental problems, so did prehistoric camels and cave bears, and most other species of the time identified in fossil remains. There's actually a case of an impacted tooth in a saber-toothed tiger found in the tar pits of Los Angeles.
I have to say, being a saber-toothed tiger and having bad teeth, that's not good for the brand, is it?
It's not really. No, I wouldn't lead with the teeth if they're all wonky and decaying. Rotten teeth tiger, that's what the animals called them behind his back. Saber-toothed tiger, wonky-toothed tiger more like. I'm here all week, Angela.
So what about humans, John? This is supposed to be a podcast about dentistry. I can't believe I'm urging you to spend less time going way back for context, but I can't bear it. So, like hunter-gatherers, how did they cope with bad teeth?
Well, we know they had teeth problems from the fossil records, but they had a better diet in terms of dental care than we have now, because they would feed on roots and berries and only a little bit of meat. Not so often a hubba bubba, very rare for a hunter-gatherer to have a curly whirly. And this is showed in the fossil records, as I was saying. It's the advent of sugar that really got going in the 17th century that made our teeth far, far worse. That's not to say that right throughout time, people haven't endured toothache.
Yeah, no doubt come up with all sorts of crazy theories for what caused it as well.
Yeah, we'll come on to that. The cartoon image of a toothache victim wrapping a scarf around their heads to help with toothache goes right back to ancient Babylonia. Can you believe that?
Wow.
The Romans did the same, and it continues right up to characters in the Beano now. I don't think it ever worked, but you feel like you have to do something, don't you?
Just wrapping a thing around the jaw. Is it like a white, like a bandage almost around the jaw? It's a real sort of...
cliche, isn't it?
Cartoon comic thing. Cliche, yeah.
But it goes back to the Euphrates, you know.
Wow. So for centuries, of course, the only way to deal with a rotten tooth was to knock the bugger out, right?
A
stone or a piece of metal or a flint would be placed against the offending tooth and it was whacked with a mallet of some sort. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. It's like that scene in Castaway. Have you ever seen Castaway, into the Tom Hanks movie?
Do you know, I've never seen the film Castaway. I've still not watched it.
Oh, well, that's such a great way of saying that he's away from civilization, because right at the top of the film, as he gets on the plane, he says to his wife, oh, I've got a slight toothache. And he's going to get it seen to when he comes back. But then he's stuck on a desert island and there's this massive toothache. And he, at the absolute low point of the film, he has to sort of like put this bit of metal in his mouth and hit it with a stone and it knocks him out. And he screams, Tom Hanks screaming in agony. You're right there. Do you know what I mean? This sort of thing that gets to you, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what it was like for humans for thousands of years. Like Tom Hanks in Castaway, except they had each other for company rather than a volleyball called Wilson.
Wilson! You haven't seen it. This is waste. I'm wasting my time.
I haven't
time.
Seen it. It's wasted on me. Sorry. So what did the ancients think caused toothache? I was like, toothache is, it's one of those pains that's like, I think toothache and earache, because they're right in your head.
Yeah.
And you can't escape them. And like, there's nothing worse than that horrible, keeps you awake, just nasty. Oh. So what did the ancients think caused it?
Well, you're not going to be surprised to learn, Angela, they got it very wrong. So,
what a shock.
Sometimes they thought it was evil spirits sent by the gods or cast by the spell of an enemy. But many cultures of the world attributed toothache to a tooth worm. That would be a tiny worm that burrowed into your teeth. And so for centuries, all sorts of cures and remedies, herbs and potions were devised to deal with the problem of tooth worms. Good, huh?
Wow. The problem which wasn't a problem.
Yeah, exactly. About 2,000 years BCE, physicians were smoking worms out of cavities using henbane seed kneaded into beeswax.
I bet there's still some hippies in Brighton doing that. I bet I could make an appointment right now, within half an hour, get that done.
The mixture was heated on a piece of iron and the smoke directed into the cavity by a funnel. And following this treatment, the cavity was filled with cement of powdered henbane seed and gum mastic.
And we'll see you in another 6 months for a checkup.
The toothworm can also be found in the Talmud from the 2nd to the 6th centuries AD. And it's amazing how long people believed in the worm.
Wow, like hundreds of years.
Yeah. The first appearance of artificial replacements for missing teeth comes in Lebanon. The Phoenicians, we think, may have used bits of shell or ceramics to put in the place of old teeth. Crazy.
Wow.
And then the Etruscans. You know about the Etruscans, Angela?
I don't know much about them, to be fair, John.
They were a small nation that occupied the hills of present-day Tuscany before the rise of the Roman Empire and the liberals from Islington buying second homes there.
Right, yes. And they produced dental bridges. Is that right? Like a replacement tooth or teeth that are mounted on a dental plate and sort of anchored to neighbouring teeth for support.
Yeah, they used gold to hold these things in place.
Wow, it's always been really expensive going to the dentist, though.
Hasn't it? Yeah. I think we're talking about the richer people of Etruscan society, of course.
Yeah.
When you get onto the ancient Greeks, Hippocrates, the ancient father of Greek medicine, he attached great importance to diseases of the dental system. And he wrote extensively about maladies of the teeth and gums. Tooth decay, he believed, was caused in part by individual predisposition and in part by the corrosive action of food and debris trapped around the already weakened teeth. So it's not actually that far off.
Yeah, he's getting there. He's getting closer than worms anyway.
Yeah.
So he also invented crude dental forceps for extractions and other dental instruments. But still better than whacking it with a rock, I think.
Yeah, we're moving on a bit.
Yeah. However, Hippocrates' dental writings do contain some fairly critical errors. He actually believed men had more teeth than women.
Maybe they do. Don't rule it out, Angela.
Well, it's quite revealing, don't you think, right? That he clearly failed to just make a simple personal examination inside a woman's mouth and just count them and check.
If only there was a way to establish whether women had the same number of teeth as men, but there's simply no way to find out.
This idea that women have fewer teeth than men survived for centuries. Nobody ever went, well, just check and count them.
No, you can't do that. And there's no need. We know they have fewer teeth.
Well, have you actually counted them?
I mean, what's the point?
I'm just saying, there's quite an easy way to check.
And now you're just becoming hysterical, Angela.
<That's>
By the first century AD, A prospective Roman dental patient could choose a physician who specialized in dentistry, who is basically a tooth drawer, a man who pulled out teeth.
Oh, he didn't draw teeth. He pulled them out. At first, when I heard you say he was a tooth drawer, I imagined him with a little sketch pad.
Well, maybe he did a sketch of what he was going to do beforehand, but draw as in...
draw out of the mouth, yes.
Yes, yeah. And this was basically the level of dental care for thousands of years, usually done by a barber surgeon, although we'll come on to them later.
Yeah.
But the Roman tooth drawer would pull out your rotten teeth and then, well, you know when the dentist says, just have a rinse... well, the first urine of the morning was advised as the medicinal mouthwash.
Yeah, and apparently the urine of young boys was considered best.
Yeah.
Dodgy that.
The young chaps were well paid for such samples.
Imagine that now when the dentist said, okay, just have a quick rinse out. No, you're all right. I'll probably just have a glass of water when I get home, to be honest. I'm fine.
No, you should always rinse out. That's the best young boy's urine available.
No, I'm fine, really. Thank you.
So this was about AD 41 that the tooth worm made its official entrance into Western dental literature, written by Scribonius Largus in the first medical...
That's a made-up name. Scribonius Largus.
It's Frankie
that's
Howard. No, shut your faces. No. Scribonius Largus. Oh, no. What's the prologue?
I'll show you a large Scribonius.
Younger viewers, how the hell what we're talking about?
Sorry.
That's what it said in the book, Scribonius Largus.
Scribonius Largus, please.
He wrote the first medical formula in the Western world, Angela.
Okay, if you say so. So, Largus, I can't say it without laughing, I'm so childish. Largus passed along the accepted wisdom that toothworms cause decay and toothache. So we're still... yeah. Believing this. And this belief would survive in mainstream Western dental theory well into the Middle Ages and among the masses for far longer, even once doctors and physicians have worked it out.
He recorded the standard cure of the time, bird seeds of henbane on charcoal. The fumes would cause the worms to fall from the teeth. And not coincidentally, henbane is a narcotic, so that probably helped a bit. So the vapour no doubt soothed them and relieved the pain.
Yes. And also, the seeds, after they've been burnt, they leave an ash that looks like little worms.
Ah.
So you could point to them and say, look, there they are, dead little tooth worms.
Yes.
Although you'd think people would go, I didn't even notice them falling out of my mouth and onto the ground.
So, yeah, so this residue was offered as proof to centuries of sufferers of the tooth worm's existence. There were other folk remedies for painful gums. One called for the scratching of the affected area with the tooth of a man who met a violent death.
How did that... Sorry. At what point... I know. Not only do you scratch it with the tooth, that... I mean, okay, fine, you might... But with a man who met a violent death, that's just an excuse. I've got to murder this man because my wife's got a bad tooth.
Sorry, mate, I like you, but you've got to die.
Yeah.
Loose tooth, he wrote, could be made firm with a whole frog tied to the jaw.
A dead frog? Live frog?
He doesn't say, actually, and it seems like quite an important detail. Like,
I'd say,
frogs crop up quite a lot, actually, in all of this. Meanwhile, the writing of Pliny the Elder suggested that telling a lie was thought to invite immediate retribution from the gods in the form of the loss of a tooth.
So Boris Johnson's got false teeth, presumably.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
So it's not bad enough that you've got toothache, right? If you've got bad tooth, people then think you're also a liar.
Yeah.
I bet he hasn't got toothache. You can't trust a word he says.
And then Galen was one of the most famous and acclaimed men of medicine in Rome. To relieve a toothache, he advised rubbing the gums with the milk of a bitch or the brains of a hare.
Do you know, I'm not sure they sell those in Superdrug anymore.
Yeah, you have to go to the prescriptions counter, Angela.
Excuse me, do you have the milk of a bitch, please?
I just imagine their faces.
No, do you have the milk of a bitch? No, it's just the way I stand. What? Oh, dear.
If the tooth protruded above the level of the others, he advised filing it down without regard to the fit with its opposite tooth above or below. And so is the tradition with all historical accounts. We jump forward a few hundred years from classical history to the Middle Ages. No one knows what was happening in the Dark Ages, Angela. You know.
But they might have had really sophisticated dentistry for all we know.
Yeah.
They might have had, you know, root canal work, orthodontic, shiny white teeth, but it's the Dark Ages, so we just don't know.
Yeah. So we jump straight to a 13th century manuscript, which roughly translates as medicine, natural remedies, and astrology.
Always good to have a bit of astrology in there when you're seeing the doctor.
Exactly. That's,
science is all very well, yeah. but I like my science to come with a little sprinkling of magic.
That's you, typical Capricorn. Now, that contained many references to dental disease and a collection of folk remedies for toothaches. It sort of echoed the disinformation that had been spread by quacks down the centuries. So for toothworms, take acorn meal and henbane seed and wax all equally much. Make them into a wax candle and burn it. Let it reek into the mouth. Put a black cloth under. Then shall the worms fall on it.
These worms.
Yeah. And then there's this remedy, Angela. Let me read this one to you.
Okay.
Take some newts, by some called lizards, and those nasty beetles which are found in ferns in the summertime. Calcine them in an iron pot and make a powder thereof. Wet the forefinger of the right hand and insert it in the powder and apply to the tooth frequently, refraining from spitting it off, when the tooth will fall away without pain. It is proven.
I love that. It is proven about something that is definitely not proven.
Exactly. Another one, a 15th century leech book. It's always good to get the latest on leeches.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was an instructional tome for the application of leeches. It offered similar therapies.
They still use leeches, by the way, in medicine.
I know.
Yeah, they're amazing creatures.
I'm not sure they do this thing, which is, for the aching of a hollow tooth, take a raven's dung and put it in the hollow tooth and colour it with the juice of a pellitory of Spain. Then put the tooth and it shall break the tooth and take away the aching, and some men say it will make the tooth fall out.
I think they were just making this shit up.
I like some men say.
some men say.
In the pub. The bloke in the pub said.
Yeah, exactly. I don't need any references, any sort of any evidence-based peer-reviewed science. Thank you very much. If some men have said it, then it must be true.
It is proven.
Thought is proven.
Yeah. Dentistry in the medieval period features travelling tooth drawers. Generally, charlatans, quacks, swindlers who travel from county to county, attending village fairs and markets and all that, making a big song and dance of the public withdrawal of a tooth.
Oh, my God. So they might have an assistant with them who pretended to have toothache.
Yeah.
And they then pretend to take out that tooth. And the actor come assistant would feign relief and gratitude at their terrible toothache. This is Del Boy stuff.
Yeah. For centuries. And then someone would be invited up from the crowd, someone who was genuinely in agony with a rotten tooth.
Oh.
And they would take out their pliers and yank it out and feel absolute agony and scream and clutch their jaw.
And that's what was entertainment in the old days.
Yes. No Netflix back then.
Oh, my God. People go and watch this. That's what I just can't believe. People go and watch this stuff. So tooth drawers, they left no written records of their own. Well, of course not. You don't, no. If you're basically a criminal, you don't leave a written record of what you've done. But we do know something of them from paintings and artwork and stuff.
Yes. Yeah. The earliest engraving of such a subject, created by Lucas van Laarden of the Netherlands in 1523. Shows the tooth puller studiously engaged in removing a tooth from the patient's mouth, and a female accomplice is meanwhile engaged in picking the patient's purse.
Oh my God. So that gives you an idea of the respect with which the tooth puller was held. Right? These were travelling crooks who took advantage of the stuffery while they're pulling out a tooth. Someone else is picking their pocket. And because they usually didn't know what they were doing, they'd leave half a broken tooth behind in the mouth, rip out half the gum, leaving it to get infected, and then go off to the next market to do it to some other poor sod. This is horrific.
Yeah, it was like, should we go down to the market? Oh, yeah. I want to see someone have their molar ripped out of their mouth and screaming in agony because I've not had a good laugh in ages.
God, people were tougher. There were no snowflakes there, were there?
Yeah, that might be a good place to take our first break, Angela.
Yeah, because I need to go and be sick.
We'll be back in a minute.
Hello and welcome back. We are talking about the history of dentistry and I am feeling a little bit queasy. The thing about these quacks is they gave dentistry quite a bad name for many centuries.
Yeah.
Because physicians ordinary doctors who had to actually be qualified, they wouldn't associate themselves with dentistry. Of course not. And they'd look down on anyone who dealt with teeth as a fraudster and a vagabond, because that's what they were.
Vagabond indeed. A strong language, Angela.
Yeah.
You'd think these quacks and tooth pullers would try and keep a low profile, but often they cut a very memorable figure. Martin Van Bushel was a small, bizarre, bearded dental quack who armed himself with a big white bone. And he rode around London on a white pony painted with purple spots.
Hey, we've all done that, John. Come on.
As spots on my pony were more Sir Reese Angela. But after Martin's wife died, Van Bushel had her embalmed and kept in his house in a glass case.
Well, he sounds fine.
I know. Making sure to introduce all his guests to her. And the crowds that resulted necessitated the following notice in St. James's Chronicle in 1775. Not wishing to be unpleasantly circumstanced and wishing to convince some good minds that they have been misinformed, no stranger can see Van Bushel's embalmed wife unless introduced by himself, between 9 and 1, Sundays excepted.
Well, she can't just turn up at his house and ask to see his embalmed wife unannounced. Seems a bit selfish. Oh, we weren't going to stay long. Just a quick look. Come on. But we will have a cup of tea if the kettle's on.
That's what your family would have done.
Yeah.
Your family would have visited Van Bushel. We're just dropping in.
Yeah, absolutely would have done. My dad on a Sunday afternoon. Come on, let's go round to see his embalmed wife. Totally would have done.
It wasn't until very late on that dentists settled down with proper dentist premises where you could actually go back and say, oh yeah, I need you to have a look, rather than I'm going to kill you because you caused me such agony.
And the pulling out of teeth was also a punishment in the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
Religious heretics and common criminals were among those sometimes sentenced to lose one or more teeth. The total they'd lose being determined by the severity of the offence.
Yeah, absolutely. So
yeah.
Eating flesh on Lent, for example, joined the list of felonies sufficiently heinous to warrant one or more teeth being marked for removal. The upper incisor and the canine eye teeth were typically the first choice, perhaps because of the ease of access at the front of the mouth and the dramatic visual impact created by their absence.
Yeah, that'll teach them, won't it? There was a belief that there was a connection between the eyes and those particular teeth, and that losing those teeth might damage your eyes as well. That's why they're called eye teeth. And if a villain really, really wanted something, he was prepared to risk that terrible punishment. And that's where we get the phrase, I would give my eye teeth for that.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
King John, who was famous for his brutality and lack of ethics, he extorted 10,000 ducats from a rich Bristol man by confining him to his palace and personally pulling a tooth a day for 7 days until his subject finally capitulated.
Well, that seems pretty brutal and unnecessarily cruel. You would have thought as monarch as well, he would have got people to do that for him. Maybe it was a point of principle for him. He said, I'm not going to ask my staff to do anything I wouldn't do myself. So here, let me torture this rich man from Bristol myself.
Exactly.
Wow.
Nice guy, King John. In 1308, yeah, the first master of the barbers was admitted to the London Company of Barbers. His name was Richard Le Barbier. So I get a feeling there's a bit of nominative determinism there, Angela.
Yeah.
He made an oath that every month he would make scrutiny throughout the whole of his trade, and that if he find among them any keeping brothels or bringing scandal upon their trade, he was to report them. So yeah, barbers keeping brothels, big problem back in the day, apparently.
Yeah, well, that's something for the weekend, sir.
Exactly.
I wonder if that's linked to that, maybe. Anyway, people listed teeth as a cause of death back then. In London's weekly bill of mortality, teeth held number 5 on the chart.
Yeah.
111 souls succumbed to complications from dental procedures. That's about 10% of all deaths.
Yeah.
Most of them died from what they called mortification, that is, infection that set in after botched operations or as a result of unsanitary practices. Because, of course, they didn't know germ theory and infection control and things like that at the time.
The other reason that the problem of rotten teeth was dealt with by vagabonds and travelling crooks is that the educated religious orders were prevented from performing any operation in which blood could be shed.
Pope Alexander in 1163 at the Edict of Tours explicitly banned monks from performing these operations. So eventually it fell to barbers instead to be the ones to pick up the scalpel. So barber surgeons were the poor man's choice for all medical operations and amateur amputations. Do you know what? My hairdresser's brilliant. I love her. I think she's amazing what she could do. I would not let her near my organs.
You don't want her amputating your
absolutely
left leg.
Absolutely not. Yeah. She's great. She's a brilliant hairdresser. What she can do with a pair of scissors, amazing.
Amazing. Go anywhere nice on your holidays as she gets the saw on your leg.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, anything that involved a sharp knife or metal tongs or a pair of pliers, you just went to the barbers. And that's why there's a red and white striped pole still used outside barbers, because there's white for the bandages and red for the blood. And I think there might have been a lot more blood than bandages, if I'm honest.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Barber surgeons would often use buckets of blood outside their shops to advertise themselves. I'm not quite sure why that was an attractive thing to do, put outside your shop, but there are all sorts of bylaws and proclamations against barber surgeons using buckets of blood to attract customers.
I mean, that's just petty interfering and meddling. Why can't you have loads of buckets of blood outside your barber's shop? That's what gives you confidence before you go in, isn't it? It's in buckets of blood everywhere.
Exactly, yeah. This guy knows what he's doing. Look at the bucket of blood outside his shop.
Buckets of blood. He's obviously a good barber.
Oh, God. As we get into the Tudor period, you'd think that things might get a bit better. But in fact, they got worse because the advent of sugar coming along, it becomes a significant ingredient in the national diet.
Of course, sugar cane that was grown in the Caribbean and imported into Europe from the 16th and 17th centuries onwards. And that's, of course, when tooth decay really gets hold and becomes an even greater problem for the teeth of the Western world. Elizabeth I was continually afflicted with dental problems in her later years.
Yes, she was described by a German visitor to her court in 1598. He recorded, "Her lips are narrow and her teeth black, a defect that the English seem subject to from their great use of sugar."
Wow, is it worth it for a cake? Yeah, probably. In 1578, Elizabeth I, was so excessively tormented by toothache that physicians were called in and consulted, and they decided to pull the tooth out. But the Queen was apparently very averse and afraid of the acute pain that would be caused. So with the Bishop of London being present, he persuaded her that the pain wasn't so much and it wasn't to be dreaded. And so to convince her of this, he would have his own tooth ripped out first.
Yeah, even though he's an old man and didn't have many teeth left, his tooth was pulled out and she was encouraged to submit to the operation herself because of that. So there's, you know, there's being a creepy crawler and then there's what the Bishop of London did with Elizabeth I.
Well, this reminds me of my dad when I was little. I had to have my ears syringed and I was really scared and was crying and wouldn't have it done. So my dad had his completely fine ears syringed first to prove to me that it didn't hurt.
Yeah. So there were, of course, no toothbrushes back in the Tudor age.
No.
It's all very different.
Yeah. Barber surgeons handled teeth cleaning as well. And they used toothpicks and bits of cloth. And what they'd do after scraping the teeth, they swabbed them with a stick dipped in aqua fortis to whiten them. And that was actually a solution of nitric acid. So, yes, it did leave the teeth considerably whiter, but it achieved this effect by basically eating away all the enamel, which caused the teeth irreparable damage. So they looked nice for a bit.
For a bit. And the crazy solutions for tooth decay continued. This gem, for example, a lizard liver put into a carious tooth sedates the toothache and has been tested in many writings. And another piece of advice here, let a green frog which leaps from tree to tree be seized and let his fat be taken out and any tooth smeared with it and immediately it falls out. Yeah, it's true. It's true, Angela. It is proven.
Yes, of course.
It's said in many writings.
Yes, by many men.
By many men, yes. As the Renaissance flowered in Europe, dentistry began to blossom. Leonardo da Vinci develops a dramatically advanced description of the anatomy of the teeth with his customary intricate drawings.
Has anyone counted up how many teeth women had yet?
I'm not sure. It seems like quite a difficult thing to organise. I mean, find a lizard liver, easy. But how do you even start to count a woman's teeth? It's possible. The advent of metallic fillings came in the 15th century. Giovanni Dacoli, who was an Italian physician and surgeon of Padua, wrote of filling teeth with soft, thin gold leaf.
Wow. Dental patients at this time generally lay on the floor or ground when receiving dental attention. And the operator would get on his knees and hold the patient's head between his knees in a sort of vice-like grip, which I think is a very reassuring way to begin any medical procedure, with your head sandwiched between a physician's
knees. Exactly, yeah.
And I can't see anything problematic in that either.
No, absolutely, definitely. No. That's Don't need anyone else in the room. No, that's fine.
No, that's fine.
A dentist in Pisa, Giovanni Platadiero, I'm just going to say that quickly, became the first...
It's a nice try, just run up in it.
just quick. He became the first dentist on record to have patients assume a sitting position when undergoing oral administrations. Ooh, fancy.
Ooh,
in a chair.
Gosh.
And then Guy de Chauliac became the first person to use the term dentist.
Sorry, you can't call him Guy de Chauliac and get away with it.
Chauliac. Guy de Chauliac or whatever. Guy de Jerusalem artichoke. He became the first person to use the term dentist, and he recommended, this is strong stuff here, knocking out patients using concoctions of opium, hyoscyamine, and lettuce.
I mean, lettuce. That's a powerful one, isn't it? I'm still surprised they haven't outlawed lettuce today.
It's when the dealers start cutting in the iceberg lettuce with the hearts of romaine and baby gem. That's when it gets really dangerous,
yeah,
Angela.
Yeah, hard stuff.
In 1530, the first book devoted entirely to dental medicine for the teeth was anonymously published in Germany.
I'm not surprised it was anonymous. Everyone was having such a terrible time at the dentist. You don't want them coming around to get their own back. Look what you've done!
The book was widely used by uneducated barber surgeons as a training manual.
God, that's not a threat. Uneducated barber surgeons is not three words you want to hear in a row, is it?
No, especially when you hear the tools they've got.
Oh my God, the tools at this time included, right, brace yourself everyone, forceps, elevator sealers.
That's what it said. I don't know what that is, an elevator sealer.
Elevator sealers. Tongue scrapers and excavators. Sounds like JCBs.
Yeah.
I mean, the images of them are enough to make anyone wince, the pictures of these tools. My God.
Yes.
Thank God this is an audio podcast, is all I'm saying.
But views of teeth and the mouth changed forever in 1683 when Anton van Leeuwenhoek in Holland turned his newly invented microscope onto scrapings from the teeth. And his discovery at a teeming, overwhelming population of little animals left him groping for comparison. The number of these animals in the scurf of a man's teeth are so many that I believe they exceed the number of men in a kingdom.
Oh, dear. But much of the history of dentistry, even after this point, seems to be mostly about pain relief or numbing the agony that resulted from having a tooth pulled out.
Absolutely. So that might be another place to take a quick break, and we'll come back to the various pain relief methods that they had during this time. See you after this.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now? The politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof, or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fern, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome back to We Are History. We've been talking about the importance of pain relief in the history of dentistry. And the history evolves from the use of henbane that we talked about to opium, lettuce, obviously.
Lettuce, very good.
And then in the 18th century, the discovery of nitrous air, better known as nitrous oxide or laughing gas.
Yes, Joseph Priestley, an English chemist, recounts his pioneering experiments in his notebooks. This particular one is actually with electricity, and I thought you should read this one, Angela.
Oh, thanks, John. I've just seen what the first sentence of this is. I see why on a British podcast you want me to say these words and not you. I killed a pretty large kitten with the discharge of a battery of 33 square feet. I endeavoured to bring it back to life by distending the lungs, blowing with a quill into the trachea, but to no purpose. Oh, God.
After discovering nitrous oxide, Priestley conducted experiments with it using animals as test subjects, beginning with a pair of mice. He didn't confine himself to science. He was a theologian, a political theorist as well, and he made himself really unpopular in the communities. The book I was reading says that one of his pamphlets he authored was responsible for inciting a mob to burn his house, his laboratory,
bloody
and his
hell.
Books all went up in flames along with the rest of it.
Wow. Joseph, it's not your political opinions or your religious theories that drove the mob to anger and arson. You killed a kitten, mate. If you're an English chemist, you don't kill a pretty large kitten with your experiments. You know nothing about English people. You can kill as many people as you like. Rip out their teeth, they'll come along and watch it, but you cannot kill a kitten.
It's basic, isn't it? It's a rule about experimenting on animals is ugly animals, fine. Pretty animals, absolutely forbidden. Basic science,
yes.
That. Stag beetle, yes. Little golden retriever puppy, no.
No.
So the problem with laughing gas was moderating the amount the subject took, and patients became delirious and frantic and violent.
Often patients would kick out and had to be strapped into the chair while their arms were tied down. Once or twice, people became so violent that they broke out of their straps and destroyed all the furniture.
And just have a little rinse there.
Yeah.
Other people were incredulous and delighted with the results, amazed at how painless the extraction had been while they were under the effects of the gas. And people got rich, particularly in America, supplying or administering nitrous oxide and later ether as a reliever of pain. It's the opioid scandal of the day.
Yeah. As the 18th century drew to a close, the wandering dentist was coming to an end. Thank God.
Yes.
And proper registered dentists started to set up practices at permanent addresses.
Yeah.
But governance of the trade was still virtually non-existent. Even an educated consumer had trouble identifying a quack from a proper dentist.
Yeah.
Because anyone could buy a dental degree for $5 to $20. So this is in America.
Yeah, yeah.
From a diploma mill like the Central University of Medicine and Science at Jersey City or the Philadelphia University of Medicine and Surgery.
Yes. One noted dentist said that the slow progress of dental societies was because the practice of dentistry had been generally considered in no higher light than a mechanical occupation or trade. So basically, doctors and surgeons were snobbish about dentists, probably because it had been the occupation of quacks and charlatans for centuries.
And I think there still is a sort of element of that, isn't there? This sort of idea that dentists are somehow failed doctors.
Oh, really? I've not really got that.
And it's mad, really, because an infection in your mouth can kill you as much as an infection anywhere else.
Yeah.
You know, it's medicine still. It's just for one part of the body. It's weird.
Yeah.
So it's very slow for dentistry to become a respected profession, where so many educated men of medicine look down so much upon the practice.
Yeah, even at this late stage, the act of filling a cavity remained a barbaric business. Not much changed from the 1400s, really. The accepted method, was using hand instruments to dig away at the decay, which is an excruciating process, and then fill the tooth with gold foil, pound it into place, which is also really painful. And then this was later superseded by a silver paste composed of filings of pure silver blended with mercury. And that was the first modern amalgam.
And the only possible drawback was that mercury, of course, the essential ingredient, is poisonous.
Yes. I mean, it's a little drawback, little things like that. I mean, technically, it's rendered non-toxic when it bonds with other metals. But, of course, it wasn't always thoroughly mixed. And the other problem was with the amalgams that the first European formulations had to be poured into the cavities at over 200 degrees.
Oh, my gosh. You've got an exposed nerve. Someone's been digging away with it with a metal spike. And then they pour in some molten metal at 200 degrees. So it still wasn't exactly a good time to have a toothache.
Yeah.
You think they would have worked out that brushing your teeth is what you should be doing a little bit earlier than they did.
Yeah. In fact, the first toothbrushes caused more problems than they solved because the bristles came off and became lodged under the gums, or the loose bristles rotted where they were stuck between teeth. So, yeah, so people needed dentures and replacement teeth. And these were carved from ivory, held in place with wire. And weirdly, the advent of syphilis advanced the case of dentistry because the disease rotted the palate, and so replacement palates were invented. And from that came the idea of using that as an anchor for replacement teeth.
So syphilis was good for something then.
Yes.
And those replacement teeth might be human teeth. This is grim. So people would forage over battlefields, taking the teeth of fallen soldiers to sell on.
Yeah.
The teeth were advertised as being from the fallen heroes at Waterloo. Imagine they'd be showing off, oh, mate, do you like my new teeth? Yes, they're from Waterloo, don't you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Or they have false teeth carved from ivory or hippopotamus teeth or walrus tusks.
Seems like it'd be a bit hard to fit a walrus tusk in your mouth, doesn't it? I'm guessing they must have whittled it down a bit, or that would make it pretty embarrassing at parties.
Just what, my new tooth? What, can you tell?
How can you tell? You got a walrus tooth, mate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this idea that George Washington had wooden teeth, that's a myth, isn't it?
Yes,
he had various sets of false teeth. They used elk, hippopotamus, walrus, cow teeth and elephant tusk, but never actually wood. Too much of a fire risk for
exactly. In fact, it was always a problem for people like Washington to keep their false teeth in, especially the upper set, which sat there in defiance of gravity.
Yeah, false teeth had little springs inside to keep them there, and they replicated the action of chewing. But these springs had to be taken out and cleaned.
Yes. So eventually the development of vulcanite was a big step forward. Hardened rubber for the anchoring of false teeth. You joked about wooden teeth being a fire risk, but actually vulcanite really was. And one English bloke, his false teeth were reported to have caught fire when he fell asleep with a cigarette in his mouth.
So 20th century, it all gets much healthier, apart from dentists, of course, getting cancer for overexposure to x-ray machines. And the kids are getting knocked out by cocktails of morphine and alcohol. And cocaine was used by dentists, and lots of them became addicted to it themselves. So, you know,
yeah,
it was better, but not ideal.
Dentists were also poisoned by repeated exposure to mercury in the amalgam they used. There'd been dental drills powered by a foot pedal for some time, but the first electric drill was introduced in 1871, which seems quite early.
Yeah.
These came via the jewellery industry, and they were initially very slow and still very painful. But it was discovered that the faster the drill went, the less pain and distress was felt by the patient. And today, drills go something like a million RPM, Angela.
Wow. The first tooth cleaning agents were actually damaging to the teeth, as these gritty powders just scraped away at the enamel.
Yeah.
And even in the mid-1930s, one whitening agent called Tartaroff contained 1.2% hydrochloric acid.
Excellent.
It was said to be brilliant. Brush your teeth with that. It was said to be capable of destroying 3% of the tooth's enamel in a single application. Brilliant. I'm pretty sure as well, wasn't there... In our episode on radon, I'm pretty sure there was radon toothpaste.
Oh, yes,
as well,
I think you're right.
20th century.
Radioactive, God.
Yeah, jeez.
As we get into the modern age, the role of dentistry became as much about cosmetics as about oral health. Children wore braces to have straight, even teeth. People had their teeth whitened, and it was a status symbol to have good, regular teeth.
And the notion of the tooth fairy, that's quite a modern one, isn't it? 19th century France had a tradition that the tooth mouse would exchange the tooth for a coin. I don't like the idea of a mouse sneaking into my bedroom at night.
No,
I'd much rather a fairy, I think.
Yeah.
And the Americans adapted this into a fairy, and that was the version, of course, that came to Britain. I don't think I realised it came via America to us.
Like bloody everything else, isn't it? My generation got lots of free money this way, but millennials are now being told by the government that that money was actually a loan and they're going to have to pay back the money with massive rates of interest. Put a little bit of satire there for you, Angela.
Yeah. Yeah, wouldn't be surprised.
There's probably a whole other podcast to do about the politics of post-war dentistry and the debate about whether it was to be included as part of the NHS. Nye Bevan and a young Harold Wilson resigning when dental charges were brought in by the Attlee government.
Yeah, tragically, today we live in an age of massively inadequate access to a good dentist.
Yes.
Massive queues form if there's ever a chance of getting on the list of an NHS dentist. I mean, forget about it where I live.
Yeah.
I don't have an NHS dentist near me. And British people in the 2020s are so desperate to deal with toothaches that, like their ancestors in the Middle Ages, they've resorted to removing their own teeth with painful and dangerous methods. It's shocking, isn't it, really, how hard it is to get dental treatment.
It's shocking. I mean, actually, that's why this one is so pressing, this episode. I wrote up my notes and planned to do this. And then the front page of the Daily Mirror today is Dark Age Dentistry.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because people are having such a terrible time with toothache and the agony of all the things we've been talking about, and they're not able to see or afford a dentist. So we've come a long way, but we still managed to slip right back. But that is the history of dentistry, Angela. I reckon the way things are going, soon you'll be able to see Angela do a stand-up show in some English market town, followed by a special act of somebody getting up from the crowd and yanking out a rotten tooth.
Lovely.
Thank you for your book, James Winbrandt.
Yes, I'm quite glad you read it and I didn't. Thank you, James Winbrandt, for writing it, but I'm not going to read it.
Yeah, I feel very lucky I can afford a decent dentist and have pretty good teeth. But it's one of those forgotten aspects of history, isn't it, Angela? Teeth have been neglected by historians just like they were neglected by their owners for thousands of years. I thank you.
Beautifully done. I want to shout out to my dad. I had quite a serious dental phobia. And then I had this brilliant dentist who specialised in people with phobias. Her name was Jenny Pinder. She's sadly retired now, but she absolutely got me over it about 10 years ago. And now I've got a local dentist to me who's brilliant. His name is Shane. He's known locally as No Pain Shane.
That's
and
good.
He's an ex-rugby player, England rugby player.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. Yeah, my dentist has a map of the world on the ceiling. So when you're lying back there, you're going, oh, look at South Sudan. I'd have got about that. It was independent. And there's a... Thank you for listening to our episode, everyone. Thank you to our Patreon supporters.
Yes, we have some shout outs to do, John.
We do. We've got Lottie Orton. Thank you, Lottie.
Mo James.
Sarah Williers.
Ben Long. If you put them together, you get Long Williers.
Oh,
sorry.
And Bronwyn Perry. Honestly, Angela, jokes about people's names, never a good idea.
Couldn't resist it. I'm sorry, Ben Long and Sarah Williers. It's just your names are together. And what's a girl supposed to do?
You giggled at Scribilius Largus. That's the level we're at.
If people don't realise that's the level we're at by now, they never will.
We'd like to thank our Patreon people. You get your episodes a week early and ad-free, and you get a few other things as well, extra bonus episodes. So if you fancy joining that, go to Angela.
I knew you were going to throw that to me. There was no way on God's earth you were going to remember the website. It is patreon.com/wearehistory. And you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram @wearehistorypod. And if you feel like it, do give us a little 5-star review on Apple Podcasts if that's how you listen to us, because it helps get us up the old algorithm.
It helps with the amalgam, doesn't it? It helps with the amalgam.
That's right. That's right, John.
Thank you for listening, guys. We'll see you next time.
See ya.
Bye.